We were discussing last time the relation between soul and nature on the individual as also on the universal level. We saw that on each plane this relation of soul to nature differs, and the state of consciousness that one has at a moment depends upon the poise of the soul regarding its nature at that moment. Consider from any point of view, this is the crux. What exactly is the relation that obtains between soul and nature? Is the soul a subject, either a willing subject or a helpless subject to nature? Or is the soul standing behind as a witness, uninterfering, perhaps taking note, but not interfering? Or is it that the soul rejects nature, turns its eye elsewhere? Or the soul, after detaching itself in the first instance from nature, thereafter assumes mastery over nature, controls and makes nature its own instrument? These are the various alternative relations possible between soul and nature. According to the particular relation we accept will be our outlook on life, our philosophy of life. We have seen Sri Aurobindo's approach, how in his integral view all the possible relations are worked out step by step as so many gradations in the evolution of the soul Godward. Once we accept this ideal, it goes without saying that the goal of our yoga ceases to be what it has been traditionally so far. We are no more satisfied living earth life as it is lived around the ego. We are not satisfied either in turning our backs on earth, the life on earth, and stepping into some beyond, leaving the earth as it is. Our aim would be rather to reproduce in ourselves that standing relation which the divine soul, which the divine being has with its nature in working out this manifestation. Not liberation, not escape, but a fulfillment of the divine will of the soul, the divine soul that is out to manifest the glory of the divine through the workings of its own active force, which we call nature. That is our objective. And the first starting point in the yoga of knowledge, the immediate goal rather, is to arrive at that basic oneness which underlies all workings in multiplicity. In life around, we see many vicissitudes, many variations, many confusions. What Sri Aurobindo calls even many perversions of relations. But all of them are deformations, malformations of this basic unity. There is oneness in the being, the divine being. Its active force of delight in the course of working out its urge to manifest passes through several phases. Half complete, incomplete, more or less complete, and according to the stage through which nature passes, there are these variations in the states of being, states of consciousness. Once by discipline, by self-observation, by going behind the surface exterior and directing our gaze behind the veil, we discover that there is a unity of existence. There is a oneness of being. All things fall into their proper perspective. This oneness, this effort of rediscovering oneness in the midst of multitude is to be done by the individual. No doubt, the universal is a larger term. The divine, the transcendent divine is still larger. But the working out of the process of manifestation, of the relation of nature and soul, is done in the individual. The nodus of ignorance is certainly in the individual at the point of his ego. But it is also due to this nodus in the individual that all movement towards progress starts. At its level, at the level of ignorance, it is in ego, on the level of ego and desire that the movement of progression starts. It changes its character as we leave behind the original impelling causes. The soul comes into its own gradually. But the person who has to work it out is the individual. In the world of ignorance, in the formula of ego and desire, it is the individual who bears the brunt of pain, evil, and suffering. As he rises higher, as the scale of evolution builds up, it is again the individual who has to aspire, who has to receive the higher charge and work out in himself a developing relation of freedom, power, and joy with nature. He begins to realize, as he progresses, that nature is not something alien of which he is a bond slave. He realizes that nature is his own force of the soul, active energy, taking shape to do his bidding. If only he becomes conscious of his self, of his real status in the soul, he gets freedom from nature. To get freedom from nature is the first step. And to get that freedom, detachment is the first step. In the midst of life, in the midst of movement, hold back yourself for a moment. You see a gulf immediately, maybe for a moment, maybe for a few minutes, you become aware of a gulf between your status of observation and the movement of nature which goes on unconcerned, whether you participate in it or not. This withdrawal, now and then, has to be gradually developed into an attitude of detachment. As this poise of detachment is repeated again and again, gets established in the being, and there is a spontaneous go back to that posture of detachment. Thank you. There is a bifurcation between nature and soul, nature and oneself. With the ascetics, this detachment is allowed to develop into a divorce. This way is not open to the seeker of the integral yoga. He has to gather up the strength, gather up the consciousness that grows in him out of detachment, and assume mastery over nature. Once you assume mastery over nature, you are in a position to manifest the divine without interference, without deformation, without perversion. The individual continues to be the agent for the manifestation, for working out the fulfillment in the cosmos. Not in cosmos alone. Even in the traditional yogas, which don't admit the ultimate reality of the world and any purpose in life, in states of samadhi or trance, concentration, utmost concentration, it is the individual consciousness that is still, that looks up to the larger term of itself, the transcendent consciousness, the absolute Brahman, and seeks to merge in it. Even there, it is the individual soul which seeks to affirm its freedom from nature, its freedom from all terms of manifestation, what it calls ignorance, and arrive at a merger in the absolute. Maybe it is the non-being, the non-existence, what is called non-existence of the Buddhist, or the soul Brahman of the Advaita, that is Vedantic monism. whichever the course chosen, positive or negative, the effect is a denial of the cosmos, which certainly is not the sole possible issue. For the seeker of integral knowledge, every step has to be related to three terms: God, nature, individual. Once the individual comes into his own, he has next to reform his relation with the world around, with people around, with movements around, with all creation, many-tiered creation around. He has to reset the relation. He has to approach them from his new angle of consciousness that he has realized. He has also to keep alive the relation with the divine that he has realized constantly on the inner levels of his being. Even in the outside world, he has to function as a center, as a channel of the divine being. It is not for him to seek any lesser destiny. Sri Aurobindo observes in a classic sentence that to conquer the lures of egoistic life on earth is the first victory. To conquer the lure of individual happiness in a heaven beyond is the second victory. The third and the final victory is to conquer the lure for escape from all this trouble and bother of cosmic life. Life has a meaning. Individual is given a consciousness, a scope, and a field to realize that meaning, help others to realize in their own lives the meaning, and manifest according to his capacity, in the mold of his nature, the divine intention. And ultimately, whatever destiny the individual chooses, it is related to the relation between his soul and nature. The soul has to liberate itself. There are 100 ways to effect that liberation. But it has to use that liberty, the freedom so gained, to conquer nature, to master nature, to direct it in the way of fulfillment of the divine will in the terrestrial universe. Any questions?
This isn't exactly in line with the talk, but the question has been puzzling me for a while. Is there a spiritual significance to the fact that there are more people on Earth now than there have ever been before in the history of the Earth?
People?
The fact that there is such a great population on Earth now, so many souls.
It only testifies to the fact that this is a growing creation. Every moment new energies, new souls are being released into manifestation from the divine source. It is only a few who choose to cancel themselves and draw back into what they call nirvana. But there is a continuous blossoming forth, emergence of truth ideas, truth lines, truth forces, souls carrying the divine spark into the manifestation. If today you find so many, day after tomorrow you are going to find much more. All the artificial methods of limiting the number are not going to make much difference, for the simple reason that the number of souls that this Mother Earth can sustain, that number is much more than what we can conceive. It is because the resources of Earth have not been properly tapped and exploited that there is this imbalance and loud lament of overpopulation. Till the optimum number that the Earth can support is reached, this process will continue. In a sense, it is illusory to speak even of this optimum number. For as the consciousness spreads, even the capacity of Earth will increase. As once Mother pointed out, the force supramental organizes itself and digs into matter, the whole plantation will turn greener. There will be more of life force, more lasting, more powerful. So the earth will become more productive as divinity enters and unveils itself progressively. Every moment, new souls are entering into the race for God, in the words of Savitri.
In Savitri, in the section that precedes the arrival of the omnipotent flaming pioneers, comes the dance, the giant dance of Shiva, tearing the path. Mm. Now, is this a prophecy of the destruction that will precede the new creation? We hear from those who have gone to America, for example, of the state of deep depression in which it is psychologically, of the increase of violence, the holding up of gangsters, glorifying them, gangsters, films, and so forth. And some Aurovillians have written back that there's an insanity felt. Does this increase of souls in subjection, as it were, in slavery, indicate that there will be this giant dance of Shiva?
The giant dance is over. The destruction is over already. The whole of old creation has been destroyed. Psychologically, physically, the old civilization is dead. The two wars and the revolutions in the minds of men, they have destroyed all the values. It is the radiant new creation that is to form itself. The present is an interim period, and what we see are only the surface phenomena of the transitional period when the old is gone and the new has not yet come. These are something like missiles in the large perspective. After all, what is this little violence, little disturbance? Why don't you see at the positive aspect of the whole thing? How all over the globe the truth force is at work, bringing out all falsehood, exposing it to ridicule, forcing men to search their hearts, forcing them to give up sham, to turn a new leaf into their lives, convincing people of the absurdity of their old ways. I do not look upon Watergate as simply a political phenomenon. It has something to do with the force that Mother has consciously released in America to drive out all hypocrisy and falsehood which is standing in the way of truth. It was somewhere 1971 that the mother felt such a black cloud of falsehood and hypocrisy in the States, work interfering, withholding scope to the work of God on earth, that she had willed a change should take place. It is common knowledge how during the last 50 years in the ashram, ever since she has founded, nobody can keep a secret. Nothing can be concealed. When Mother was asked about it, she says, "Yes, I have set into operation a particular force which will not allow anything to remain secret, which will expose everything to everybody's eye. That is at work." Now, something of that kind has been released in the States, from where Mother expected so much. And I suppose she still expects. This is a cleansing process that is going on. It is a pity that this Watergate affair started only recently. Otherwise I would have got verbal confirmation from Mother as to how far it is a result of her direct working. But we have not been able to talk freely during the last 2-3 months. We have not seen her for the last 1.5 months. But I have no doubt whatever that it is a process, cleansing process. Even in India, it is unthinkable how things are being brought out, exposed. All people in high authority, their feet of clay being exposed all human props, institutional props, are being systematically exposed, and the lesson is being brought home that only in truth, only in the divine support lies the way. Over each individual evolution, there is in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy what is called the central being. In Indian terms, it is called the Jivatma. For our purpose, Sri Aurobindo's characterization of it as the central being is enough. Now this central being is always above the evolution, stands above, supporting it, witnessing it. But it is not all above, because it projects a small emanation of it into this evolution. That central being is always in touch with the divine, with the parent divine. There are a million central beings, say, all of them derive directly from the manifesting divine and are in touch, linked with it. Now this central being projects a ray of it, an emanation of it, in this movement of individual evolution. This entity, this is called the psychic essence. It is a point of consciousness linked to the central being and therefore linked with the divine consciousness. This point of light, this point of consciousness is called the psychic essence. Gradually, by evolution, by the gathering of experience, this essence becomes an entity. This entity further, life after life, develops into what is called a being, the psychic being. Now this psychic being may be loosely called the soul. What we call soul in normal philosophy is the psychic being. But it's not all that. There is a part of the soul which is the self standing behind. There is a part which is involved and growing in evolution. Now that part of the soul which is involved in evolution and growing in evolution is called the psychic being. So for our purposes we may say that the soul involved in evolution is the psychic being. The soul that is not involved but stands behind is what the Upanishads call the self, S-E-L-F. That is not involved, but it has to support. So there are three. There is the central being, Jivatma. There is the self, the Atman. There is the psychic being. the psychic purusha or the soul as involved in evolution. This psychic being grows by experience, and as it grows in consciousness, it develops many personalities. The more it develops, the more personalities it gathers, it grows nearer the divine. The climax in its evolution is reached when, in the process of growth and expansion, the psychic being links up with the Jivatman, with the central being. In a sense, that is the end of individual evolution. Thereafter, whatever is to evolve and all that, it is left entirely to the divine will. Till then, there is the range of personal effort, there is scope, there is the necessity of personal aspiration. Till each one of us, through our psychic being, links up with our divine portion above, we have to make the effort. Thereafter, the divine takes charge. I should have said instrumental personalities. Personalities, mental personality, vital personality, all these, psychological. The psychic being expresses itself, builds, so as to say, these personalities on the surface. It stands behind. And the more the personalities it is able to organize around itself, the more evolved, the more mature it becomes. It may not carry the personalities it builds in this life to the next birth, but the essence of that experience of these personalities, that forms part of its capital for the next birth. Yes. Jivatman is above. The Atman is part of the projection of the Jivatman, which is standing behind. It is not above. The self involved in the self of an individual, what is called the Atman, is behind. It is not above. Above, behind, front. There, you may say, there are so many poises of the divine, so many poises, necessary poises in the course of manifestation. It's a way of putting things. It's the central being, the Jivatman itself, standing behind, is the self, Atman. It is an emanation. It is a part. But though again we are using human language to describe a superhuman phenomenon. But there can be no part, but for sake of our clarification, for our understanding in terms of the intellect, we have to say it is a portion. Just as we say the central being is a portion of the divine, the psychic being and the self, the soul, is a portion of the central, is an emanation of the central being. Yes. When you become conscious of the self, you feel separate from all movement, from all nature. You are alone, passive. One in peace, undisturbable peace. Nothing else exists at that time. When you experience the central being, you get a sense of freedom coupled with the action of overseeing. It oversees all that goes on, along with freedom. There is a vertical dimension to the experience of the central being. When you become conscious of the self, you automatically become conscious of the selves of others, because the self is extended all everywhere, the same self everywhere. So at that level, you experience a sort of horizontal unity with the whole universe. In the psychic being, when you experience, there is an emphasis on the individual aspect of manifestation. Still some doubt? I think if you read the section on psychic being, the central being, in the letters by Sri Aurobindo, the first volume, things will be clearer after what we have talked. Because he has developed the philosophy of the psychic in letters more than what he has done in the Life Divine or the Synthesis. The practical aspect of the matter is in the letters. In the Life Divine, I think he has emphasized that it is a projection of the bliss self. There are, you know, five selves: the physical self, the vital self, the mental self, the knowledge self, the bliss self. There are so many, what you call, bodies in man, each ensouled by that particular self. At the inmost depth, there is what is called the bliss self. And the psychic being is the deputy of the bliss self. The double soul in man, in Life Divine, first volume, perhaps you might look up. But that, after you read well the section on psychic being in the letters, which has been extremely categorical in his definitions there. Because this concept of psychic being and its philosophy is not there in Indian philosophy or Western philosophy anywhere. What is called the psyche in Greek thought is quite different from what Sri Aurobindo means.
You spoke of the many ways of liberating the soul. Where would you indicate the sources for that?
the yogic tradition is there, the mystic tradition is there. There are the traditional ways of liberating oneself through the way of knowledge, through the way of love, through the way of works, through the way of the pursuit of sound, through the way of a progressive dissolution of the nature part of oneself, dispossessing oneself of all that is not properly the soul, so that only the soul remains. It remains till that too is joyously dissolved in the vaster soul of existence. There is Mother Sri Aurobindo's way, which combines the principles of most of these paths, so that any individual can start where it is natural for him and derive support and help from all the personalities of his being and nature and formulations of his nature. In a sense, Sri Aurobindo's yoga is the easiest, just as in another sense it is the most difficult. It is easy because one doesn't rely upon one's own effort. One has only to be sincere and open oneself to the higher yogic power, the divine power, to work into one's being. And that does the sadhana. The human effort is a supporting action, a sustaining activity. All that is required is sincerity and surrender. But it is difficult because one is called upon to change one's nature. This change of nature is essentially a personal effort. The divine can, here the divine can sustain, can guide, can help, but it cannot affect the change itself. The human will has to do it. There comes the most difficult part of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. And both the processes are so interwoven that after a certain stage is reached, the next door cannot be opened to the descent of the still higher force unless some change is made in our nature. So it is a combined endeavor, human and the divine. Yanis, we could say that the central being presiding over the evolution of each individual. Each is an individual poise of the divine. So each central, each jivatman is conscious not only of its unity with the parent divine, but of its oneness with the several central beings on earth. When it projects itself, puts an emanation of itself in evolution, individual evolution, in my scheme, necessarily that emanation has the character of the central being. There is a part that is conscious of its union with others, and a part is involved for progress. That is the psychic being, this is the self, and overseeing both part formulations of itself is the central being.
Behind. Stands behind.
It is our job to bring it out. The psychic being stands behind. The psychic world also stands behind the gradation of worlds. The psychic world is not one of the many planes that each one has to ascend. It stands behind, supporting all. It is the soul, in the individual frame context also. The psychic stands behind, supporting the physical, the vital, the mental. All the three form a nodus, as it were, in the psychic being. It should be the endeavor of every seeker to gradually open the way and draw out this psychic being to come to the front. First, by aspiration, by creating the necessary climate of truth, harmony, love in our external being, an attempt is made to draw out some ray of the psychic being. It comes, strikes the being, outer surface, withdraws. And so, gradually the influence of the psychic being percolates into the surface. By cultivation, by extension of the area to which, on which this influence can act, the field is created for the psychic being itself to eventually emerge and assume the captaincy of the ship of life. The inconscient does not enter into the scheme of the tantras to which Sri Aurobindo makes mention in his writings. They never went to that, the ancients never went down to that level. They just described it metaphorically as the worlds underground. They speak of 7 or 14 worlds, one below the other, describe it, worlds of darkness, worlds of glittering wealth, worlds of enjoyment, worlds of perpetual misery and all that. But they never brought it into the scheme of transformation. They spoke of change only on the levels above the subconscious. So these are two different contexts. The question of inconscient arises only where the transformation of the kind Sri Aurobindo and Mother envisage is attempted. It is a wholesale transmutation of human nature into a divine nature. This was not admitted quite as a practical possibility in the ancient systems. They admitted it as a theoretical possibility. But all agreed ultimately that the physical is a stumbling block and there is nothing to be done with it. There are sciences in India, there were at any rate, which attempted by combining yoga and medicine, particularly using certain compounds of mercury, herbal juices and the like, to change the substance of the physical substance of the body into something that would transcend death. But it was only an attempt. It was a mechanical means used to reach an end that was above mechanism. That is why it did not succeed. Each individual does not have to repeat that process. He has to apply that solution in his case. Each one has to apply that solution. These problems are to be faced as they come up and as they compel attention. One shall not seek for them to solve them.